We are deep in the heart of, so to speak. We're sitting somewhere here between the mid-cities and hell.
I think that's a reference
don't
to
forget
Hurricane
the blue
Katrina.
Roof.
Yes, it is.
The blue roof and the big pile of hurricane debris outside.
It is. It's right out there. You know you're at home in New Orleans when you see the blue tarp and the trash out in front. One of those wonderful New Orleans homes that is just ramrod straight. What do we call these?
Shotgun.
Shotgun houses. And, you know, we might need to get a shotgun before all this is over because I have a feeling these folks are going to let loose with both barrels. I'm here today with the Pfister sisters. And why don't you all introduce yourself? There is going to be a manly voice in here. He's not exactly a sister, but an integral part of this group. So
I thought you were talking about Holly.
No, this Mr. Pfister.
Mr. Pfister. So go ahead. Let's start with Mr. Pfister.
Mr. Pfister, alias Amosy Miller.
Very good. And working our way around the corner.
Well, I'm Holly Benson. I would be the founding Pfister from many years ago. It was the first crazy person to call up other people and say, I know we could sing this music. Let's try it. And Amosy is my musical husband of the past 27
right.
years. I've been with him longer than my actual husband.
And I'm Yvette Volker, and I was the one of Holly's original victims.
That's right. You were a mere high school student.
I was fresh out of high school, and Holly said, oh, look, we've got this weird stuff to sing. And I was young and like, oh, cool. And yeah, let me spend the rest of my life trying to master this stuff.
Always had a strong work ethic.
<That's right. laughs>
Thank God.
So, I was the original baby, but no longer.
I'm Debbie Davis, and I'm the most recent acquisition into this strange little Kool-Aid cult here. I've been with the group for about 7 years, and when Susie Malone, one of the original members, left, a mutual friend of Holly and mine recommended me to come in as a replacement.
Yes, I believe she said, oh, she's young and crazy. She'll
yeah.
learn it.
Lee Harris, Little Queenie, that's recommended right. Debbie, and that's a real good friend of ours and another yeah. musical spouse of Amosy's. And, she said, no, you got to call Debbie. She'll pick up all that stuff just like that. That's what she said.
Yeah.
And it was really true.
It's always wonderful to be around really great musicians because you feel that magic that is created. And it is a magic. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the really interesting things about what you guys do is how beautifully you've blended your sounds. It's just fabulous.
Thank you.
So one of the things I have to ask, though, and Holly, this is probably kind of directed to you. So how did this all start? Did the Boz kind of appear to you one night and say, go ye forth and sing?
Well, not exactly like that. You know, I've I first moved to New Orleans in 1974. And I used to go out every Thursday night and hear this band I really liked at the Maple Leaf Bar. And the band was called Kirk Cassin and the Wheeler Sisters. And they did a lot of jump, jive, swing kind of music. Few friends of mine played in it, the Malone brothers. John Malone played bass, Tommy Malone played guitar. Bruce Rayburn, who directs the Hogan Jazz Archives, was the drummer. Kirk Cassin was the front man on guitar. And the Wheeler Sisters were two girls who are now stockbrokers, if you can believe that. Mm. One had the low voice like me, Lisa, and the other one the mid-range voice. And they would blend with Kurt and do the trio stuff with Kurt. What happened was that one day Bruce was in a record store flipping through the cutout record bins, you know, with the records you could buy for $2 or $3, and he comes across the Biograph reissue of the Boswell Sisters that has a nice photograph on the front, and it had to come out in the early 70s. So he said, oh, this is interesting, you know, these people, you know, I heard they were from New Orleans, let me pick up this record. He bought the record, and after he did that, he and Lisa were listening to it at home, and she said, well, you know, this is our range, we can do these songs. He said, wouldn't it be exciting to perform some of these songs? So they used to perform Sentimental Gentleman from Georgia, Sheltering Palms, and Put That Sun Back in the Sky. That was the three Boswell songs they consistently had in their repertoire. And I remember talking to him about it, you know, where'd you get these songs? And he told me, and I went out and bought the same record. And that's when I started wanting to do that music. Boswell repertoire was natural to me because I'm kind of a girl baritone in voice, and I don't think I'd ever heard any women singing in that low of a pitch before, and that was very impressive to me. And I said, well, this is exactly my range. I could do this, and I was a born harmony singer. When I was a kid, singing with the radio in the car, I never sang the lead. I always sang the harmony.
Right.
And
I think we all did that.
Yeah.
Well, my mom was a soprano. She already had the melody, so I can take that.
There was no room for you, and you're an alto. So
right. I was always singing the French horn part, no matter what the music was.
Right.
I told you I was talking to a very good 40s musician the other day about the Boswell Sisters, and she says, oh, I adore Connie Boswell. I love the Boswell Sisters. They're just so good. And I said, well, do you ever do their music? And she said, Well, no. And I said, well, why? And she said, well, because it's like theater. You'd have to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse and rehearse to get that right.
Yeah.
And then, strangely enough, I saw a comment from probably what was a very youthful Yvette Volker in an interview saying, we have to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse and rehearse to do this Pfister Sisters music. You've been essentially rehearsing now for how many years?
20, going on 27.
27 years. And yeah, we do rehearse.
Well, you think that... that's one of the reasons that you don't find too many people doing this music?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Who's got the time?
Yeah. Well, and the other point is that another review said about us of years ago, which is that it is very unusual for singers of this caliber to be willing to work together and blend. And that, you know, once you get to a certain level, people, you know, you just want to be a solo singer. You just want to do your thing.
It's easier to work that way,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it's easier to work that way. It's cheaper. You know, economically, it's you're only buying one chick instead of three.
Well, and just making decisions for musical reasons and for business reasons, doing things by a committee of three women is like...
Right. What you're going to wear.
Just doing a committee of three women is like launching a missile from a nuclear submarine, except it's like twice as difficult and three times more of a sensitive issue once you finally get down to it.
But is that... Now, if you look back at the stories about how the Boswell Sisters work together, of course, you'll get conflicting reports, but they seem to have argued a lot.
Oh, yeah.
When they were working on their music. Does that ever happen with you three?
Oh, no.
No, never. We never argue.
Never.
Watch Amosy start
doing my way.
Yeah, right. Yeah, poor Amosy, sometimes you can see him at the piano because we'll be gathered around the piano and we'll start hunching over him and he'll start hunching further down.
We've been known to have a 2-hour argument over one note.
That's right. I love it when people come over and go, oh, I'd love to watch our rehearse. And it's like, oh, no,
no,
you wouldn't.
It's not always
and you are not allowed. No one is allowed.
No, you cannot come and watch us rehearse because then you'd have to testify the commitment here.
That's right.
If you can imagine what it took when we were first learning this stuff, we didn't have the technology we have these days. So we're working off a cassette tape recorder, trying to slow down the double dog Latin sections
of songs to figure out what the hell those Boswell women were saying. Yeah. So I can vividly remember sitting in Amos's kitchen and we're all like trying to slow this thing down. We're putting in old batteries. We're doing everything we can.
Right.
We don't have a way to slow it down otherwise. It's a tape recorder. Right. And I remember somebody saying, "Ah, yes, Sergal Dur, Thagal, that's my bagel baby." And the other person said, "Yeah, that makes sense."
And then we all stop and go, "Huh?
We are crazy."
This is what I meant about the commitment here.
Right.
Yeah.
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 Well, the other thing that the slow tapes did is that the original charting of a lot of this was, I didn't know what keys they were originally in necessarily. And I didn't, for some reason at that point, I just wrote them down in whatever key I heard it on the tape.
Right.
Well, in a lot of cases, that ended up being horrible keys.
Yeah,
like a half tone from the real key.
Right. A half tone, it turns out a half tone. And the horn players used to hate it. I mean, like, I didn't like it that much myself. But once I wrote it in that key, you know, it wasn't like I could push a button and change the key of the chart. So
not
I
that day.
E and that was it.
You didn't have the Irving Berlin piano, yeah.
So some of them, things like... was it
Everybody Loves My Baby? Was it F sharp?
It was an F sharp.
Right.
And the horn players hated it.
Right.
And finally, you know, about a year ago, I
years
just
later
it out in G minor.
Right.
You know, and which
and
is where it was.
And suddenly it's like,
which is where, you know, when it, but it, you know, we weren't, most of the time when you're working with vocalists, you find the key that's right for them. But here there's three vocalists, and really the key doesn't matter. You just stack people differently.
Right.
You know, if it turns out one person can't sing one of the parts.
It's like, I'll take the melody until it gets up to the D. And then I'll tag you in.
That's right.
I'll drop a third. Holly can jump up.
Well, for example,
well, we learned that from
A, which horn players hate. Mood Indigo is almost always an A flat or B flat for
right.
the horn players are doing it. And we're doing it in A. For some reason, we haven't put that one up or down. And
because
no, I think you want it there.
Yeah,
you
well, because it stretches
really
all of our ranges right there.
Yeah,
my
right,
high
right.
and Holly's low
so
are at the...
So there we have no choice.
The breaking point.
Well, and now isn't that kind of an interesting little thing, too? Because I guess the Boswell sisters, when they were singing, they would switch off based upon whose range it was, who would carry what line.
Mm-hmm.
You guys do that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they would cross a lot of times. They would do, like, one would start here and the other would start at the bottom and they'd cross just to get those lines, those interesting harmonic lines in. Because sometimes those are much more interesting than the pat ones that, like, the Andrews sisters do.
Right.
They always do the pat ones.
Literally.
They always do a moving part and the other people do pads a lot of times. And the Boswells really almost never did that.
Yeah, and that is one of the things that really makes them unique, yes?
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so many things make them unique. The fact that they were recording multi-vocal popular music.
In the 1920s.
Before anybody else was thinking about using more than one singer. Up until then, any recordings that had more than one singer were choral or classical, and that's just the way it was because the music hadn't been invented to accommodate more than one singer.
There were the Brock sisters and the real straight-ahead groups, but they were the first people to do it with the rhythm.
To do the jazz
style. Yeah.
And
that just came from growing up here. It just came from the influences they had as growing up as children.
But I mean, it came too from the fact that there weren't any rules at that time. It wasn't, you have to use this instrumentation. It wasn't, there weren't any rules yet. And so you don't hear the rest of the jazz community really catching up with what they did as far as time and tempo changes until the 30s, until the 30s and 40s. In some cases, until the bebop movement in the 50s and 60s,
well,
you don't hear that kind of progressive change in the alteration of form and style of a well-known song.
Right. Of course,
until people like Coltrane and Miles Davis came and flipped it over.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because we just learned I'm Putting All My Eggs in One Basket, which Cynthia was telling us was the last ever recorded song of the Boswell sisters. And I was telling David McCain, our other Boswell guru, how difficult it was to learn it. And he says, well, I thought it was a much straighter piece, because, Decca, by that time, the record company started pounding on the girls to straighten out, to not do all the rhythm changes and the tempo changes. And so, the band is playing a single tempo through the piece, but the girls are all over the place, and they're harmonically, they're doing all kind of interesting things, and we had to, it was like taking apart a puzzle. I mean, we had to take it apart and put it back together. And
but they would take one song, and even if the band did one thing with it all the way through, they would rearrange
the
lyrics and move them to different parts of the measure and take the melody and revamp it and put emphasis on different syllables. I mean, there was just, the only way they could do it was for them to do the complicated parts. I think I think a lot of the musicians just finally went, you know, I'm going to go play Satin Doll with Duke Ellington. Y'all can do whatever. Bye.
Yeah, well, I think the really cool and hip ones at the time were like into learning it and doing it, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, you guys have been doing this for a while, and you have quite a following locally. I guess you pack them in, as they say at Jazz Fest. In fact, I've seen some reviews of your music during Jazz Fest, and they come back and the picks of the day. That's where I almost always find you, in the archives. The pick of the day, the Pfister Sisters. There was no seating left in the economy tent. They were spilling out, and people just loved this
we're
music.
We're very often spilling.
Well, that may have
part of the charm.
You're going to have to come see us live, folks, to really find out.
And yet, this music, for all its wonder, hasn't gotten very far away from its core here. There are some Eastern groups, obviously, who do this, but they don't really do it like you guys, and they don't have much of a... It hasn't exploded like you might think it would.
Well, I think a lot of that is it's hard to put this music in a box. You know, you can't dance to it, you know, which is always
unless
kind
you're
of
a really good
unless
dancer.
You're really good.
Or a really bad one.
Right. Yeah, little kids are fine. They love it. They can dance to it. They're great. But that's a lot of it is a lot of times a musical entree to a band is the rhythm, and people can dance and they can kind of bounce around and listen. And you can't, with us, you have to listen. And that's, I think, part of it. It's complex.
There's been a lot of people over the years who have done it. The first place I heard people do Boswell Sisters, besides my Kirk Cass and Wheeler Sisters group here locally, there was a group out of England that did a lot of Boswell material, Sweet Substitute. And I saw them when they traveled here for a jazz festival. There also was the Sweet Hots from New York, Wavelength from Toronto. I think there are some people on the California coast that do the period of music and do a few tunes. There's probably nobody that does what we do. And Jan Shapiro up at Berklee Music School did a beautiful recreation of the Boswell Sisters.
Boswell Mania.
Well, actually, she had a trio, and they were all voice teachers. Mm-hmm. And the first time I saw them at the Jazz Educators Convention that was in town, and I went to see their show. And in they come, and they've got one of the members that's in the group is in a wheelchair. And my first thought was, gee, they've really gone to great lengths to recreate this. And then finally I realized, oh, she really is in the wheelchair.
Right. Congratulations, you've got the job.
And she did the Connie voice. She did it beautifully. And they did probably a more perfect recreation of the Boswells in a way than what we do. But the thing we do is we bring the New Orleans into it and keep it into it. We're not exactly replicating what they did, but we're doing it as if they still lived in New Orleans and played with local boys all the time.
Right.
So we know we can't recreate what they did because we don't share the same genetics, upbringing, voices, inflection. But we do is our own special thing. And what we do is represent for our sisters, the Boswell Sisters, to the rest of the world. And we, you know, I'm a teacher by degree and trade, and all our performances are going to educate you. For
like
damn sure, whether you want to hear it or not.
Well, and the other thing when you think about it, I mean, like, for example, the Heebie-Jeebies, they recorded that 5 or 6 times. It sounds different every last time. So, you know, they were continuing to move and grow and change and do something different. And so, and that's kind of what we do. I mean, we try to learn what they did and then, you know, put a little bit of stamp to it, give a little bit of that extra sway or swing or push or something to
it. Or when we get so used to doing something for a while and we stop... Which, I mean, it's not always the best thing occasionally, but when we stop referencing the source material so hard because we're just so in the habit of doing something, we just, by sheer repetition of doing it only with each other, we start unconsciously putting different inflection or different movement across a phrase. And then it's always a surprise to go back and hear the source material. I go, wait, that's not how they did it. And wait, that is how they did it. That's not how we, sorry.
Right.
Now, y'all are based in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Katrina had quite an impact on you.
Oh, yeah.
Holly, I know your home was flooded.
I had 2 houses that flooded.
Yvette and Debbie, you were evacuated. Amosy, I don't know.
My other house had flooded too.
Yeah, and you kind of were flung to the far edges of the earth for a little while.
Pretty much.
And I think New Jersey is about 20 miles past the far edges of the earth. But close.
Oh, Amosy was in Ithaca. That's even further.
But weren't you some of the first folks to come back and regroup and put it all together again?
We actually were.
Yeah.
We actually were back 7 weeks after.
Yeah, in fact, seven. I think you and I came. We got back into town.
We got back first. Because, mm-hmm. number one, I couldn't stay with my sister a bit longer in Memphis. Karen, I love you, but I couldn't
stay
there any longer. Right. And I was anxious to come home, so I came home, and Yvette was already back. Her house hadn't flooded.
The minute they turned electricity on, it was like, oh, no, we're back.
Yeah, yeah. And we started gigging with our we have a sub that, believe it or not, there's a fourth person that has learned at least two of the parts to this, and she can sub for either me or Debbie. We're working on getting the soprano sub, should that ever occur, so Yvette could, if she wanted to run off to the Bahamas,
or,
she could.
Or have a nervous breakdown.
Or have a day off. But
we'll have none of that.
Yeah, so we started working back with sub piano players. And
that's right.
Karen, tell Karen's last name, I would never say it right.
Karen Storr.
Karen Storr, our sub, came in, because she had been so badly flooded, she lived in Lakeview. And she has six kids, and they were living in a 30-foot RV in her husband's work parking lot. She was happy to come out and sing songs with us.
Oh, yes.
Well, and we were fortunate enough that right before the hurricane hit, we had done three songs with the Dukes of Dixieland for their Christmas record. And we were the last people to record at Ultrasonic Studios before they got their 16-channel board out and their digital mixer out. And our masters and everything else is gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we did three songs with the Dukes of Dixieland, and they were in Las Vegas.
Right. But they work traditionally or regularly in New Orleans. They work on the Natchez Steamboat.
Natchez. And the manager of the Dukes called us up, and since we had been working with the Dukes, although we had never rehearsed any of our actual material with them.
Come sing with us.
So we did a benefit tour on the Natchez with the Dukes of Dixieland that started in Cincinnati, came down the Ohio River into the Mississippi River, and theoretically back to New Orleans.
Right.
But we had 3 weeks of work on a steamboat with a bunch of New Orleans musicians, and that, I think, emotionally and spiritually was a saving grace for a lot of us, because it was, you were far from home, and right. You know, and didn't even know exactly how home was. I mean, I hadn't been back to my house.
Yeah. Yeah, she flew directly out to meet us, right?
But
it was
like being home, because it was familiar faces, and you got to see them every day, and you got to talk about home.
Yeah. Right.
So
Luther Kant was on that trip too, and he would do Louisiana, and every time he'd do it, we'd just sit on the side and cry.
Everybody just
you guys would sit on the side and cry. I had to leave the room. The first time he did that, I had to get up and go out on deck and bawl my eyes out.
Because you didn't want to do the ugly cry.
That's right.
No, and there was no pretty cry with that.
We at Bozzies.com believe that New Orleans needs the sounds of the Boswell sisters more than ever before. What's y'all's take on that?
Absolutely.
Yes, I vote yes.
Yeah, our Wednesday nights have become, we do a regular Wednesday night at the Spotted Cat, and a little lady came in the other day, and what we have discovered is since the storm, we get a lot more locals. They're coming in more regularly. It's like all of a sudden people really understand that, next week may not be here. I mean, they really get it now.
Also, everyone's been evacuated, and you didn't miss your water till the well went dry. Before it was...
I'll go next week.
I'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or, I can see them anytime, that kind of thing. But now it's people so much more appreciate the chance to participate in our culture. And tips have improved as well.
Yeah.
And
which is funny because everybody's broke.
Right. Yeah, everyone's broke, but yet everyone's spreading their FEMA money around.
Well,
the Boswell song? Let's spend it, lend it, send it, rolling right along.
That's right.
And people are pulling together so much, and dedicated tourists such as yourself and believers show up, which is wonderful. And the thousands of kids that came from the colleges to help people during spring break, I love that.
Let's shift to something slightly different. Not only have you been performing Boswell Sisters music for 20-some years, you've also performed for a Boswell sister.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Very exciting.
We went up to New York, and we wanted to meet Yvette Boswell. So our dear friend David McCain, who you call the Wizard of Boz, which is the best name for him I've ever heard.
Yeah. I can't believe we didn't come up with it.
No, I can't believe we didn't think of that. And so he gets... Chica was there, and Dick Minerly, her husband, at the time she was probably divorced from him, but somehow he was in the picture too. And they brought Vet in to town. They were some of them lived in town in New York City, and some lived in Peekskill. Anyway, she came in, and she came to this little club where we were playing, and she just loved it. And she got up on stage, and that was it. After that, she never sat down again. Right. She sang every song. Okay, let's try. So we call a song. We go, "Everybody Loves My Baby." Oh, that's a great number. Let's do that one.
Right.
She never would sit down. You'd have had to get the hook to pull her off the stage.
But that was when that's when we finally got the explanation too for the double dog.
For all of it.
We had learned it phonetically, which is insane.
Which wasn't right.
Right. And then she explained, "Oh well, it's you have
it's got rules
like pig
to
Latin.
It.
It's got rules, and you put your GGLED in the middle of your word, and there you go." It's like,
it was much easier after that.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right.
Sure it does.
If I decided to come to New Orleans for vacation, where should I go to find the Pfister Sisters?
Well, first you can go to PfisterSisters.com. That's PfisterSisters.com, or visit us on MySpace at MySpace.com/PfisterSisters. That's where you can go first, and then when you come down here reliably, you can find us at the Spotted Cat, which is at 627 Frenchman Street. Is that right?
It's Frenchman between Royal
Charters
and Charters.
Directly across the street from DBA, and we are there every Wednesday from 6:30 to 9:30. And
we do a Sunday brunch every Sunday at the Brasserie Marigny on the corner of Frenchman and Royal,
which is 6:46, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
11:30 to 2:30.
11:30 to 2:30
on Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's breakfast with booze. There's $2 mimosas and cheese grits. Yeah. There's no way to oversell this.
Yeah. So the part of what we started to say is we've become like therapy for town, because people come. Like, we had a little lady came and she said, "I just love coming to your gigs. Y'all make me laugh." Because we're up there, of course, processing our various FEMA stories and horror stories, and we talk about them up there and laugh about them and make up new words to songs to celebrate what's going on, and And people are like, "Oh, we love this." It's like we're like therapy.
So we are processing. Everybody in New Orleans is going through post-traumatic stress disorder together at the same time.
Yep.
And we find it better to be here than elsewhere, because at least you can process it with your neighbors,
somebody understands.
In the grocery store line, the policeman on the corner. Anybody understands.
Right.
And if you go other places, they're going about other lives that have nothing to do with the post-K landscape. And really, I can't even get interested in it, because I'm so worried about my own city and my own place. And you know, we love New Orleans, like Becky and Ricky say, Becky Allen and Ricky Graham, you love New Orleans hard. Because it's hard to be here sometimes, but if it's in your heart and it's your home, you're not going anywhere else. And traditional jazz musicians, where else will we live, you know?
I mean, there are places that you can live, but there's no place else as interesting for me. There's no place else as exciting where such important things are happening that are shaping the landscape of our country in the 21st century.
It's dynamic.
Everything else is boring by comparison. This is where I want to be.
Oh, this is what my daughter said about it. My daughter was in one of the many documentaries showing up. And it was somebody filmed her and her boyfriend going back to their flooded house in Gentilly for the first time. And literally, the water was over the roof. There was literally nothing left there, you know. And they were asking her, why do you want to stay? She was saying they didn't exactly think they'd rebuild in that spot, but they wanted to stay. And they go, "Why do you want to stay?" And she goes, "Well, you know, when you grow up in New Orleans, you're growing up in Oz and you don't know it." She says, "But you know, when you go to other places, every place else is Kansas." <She's>,
it's kind of interesting. There's a Connie Boswell interview done in mid to early 70s with Richard Lamparski. She and Vet are in the interview. And she's talking about coming back to New Orleans and how when she came back here, of course, she sang everywhere, but when she'd come back here, she'd want to get out her saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
But she also said that the real jazz bows don't want to leave New Orleans. So I guess you all have sort of pegged yourself as being a part of that that spirit. And
well, we want to travel, but this is our home.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and not to forget
well,
that.
A lot of New Orleans musicians don't even want to travel.
Yeah. Right. Well,
some
yeah,
of the best ones
you're
don't
right.
want to leave.
You're right.
You can't get them out.
Right.
They're scared to get on a plane. They don't want to be anywhere else. They can't eat anywhere else.
Right.
Nobody likes the other food. That's another problem.
I remember a conversation I had with a couple of brass band musicians who had just been to Europe, and they came back, and they had been to Amsterdam, and they had been to Prague, and they had been to Moscow, and they had been to Rome and Vienna, and I mean, the crown jewels
of the cool places
in the European crown. Mm-hmm. And I said, so, you know, how was Paris? How was Rome? What did you do? I said, well, nothing. We had gigs at night. I was like, well, so what did you do during the day? Did you go to the Louvre? Did you go, you know, what did you see? Oh, we sat in the hotel room and played cards and talked about the Treme.
Right.
It could happen.
Okay.
I've witnessed people like, you know how Louis Armstrong used to carry the red beans and rice with him when he traveled?
Oh, yeah.
That's happened a lot more. Gerald French told me he was checking out at the grocery store and he had 20 pounds of camellia red beans in his basket.
Right.
And he had the Louisiana rice and they were going, oh, you must, the checkout girl's going, oh, honey, you must be staying out of town, huh?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm in Shreveport. Shreveport, Louisiana, too far away from
New
Orleans.
That's right,
yeah.
Well, 5 hours in a world away.
I was actually in a hotel room in Houston with Kermit Ruffins once when my husband was doing a gig with him. He invited us over to his room to talk about the charts for the gig that night. We go over there and he is sitting out there in his room. He's got his radiator turned all the way up to 10, the blower on high, and he has 2 big pieces of tin foil and all this sausage and chicken and barbecue sauce, and he is doing a sausage and chicken barbecue on the radiator in his hotel room.
I believe you.
So, you know, no matter how far away you go, there are some things you just, you can't fake.
So, world, watch out. New Orleans, our dispersion means that our culture is coming your way.
Yeah.
Whether you're ready or not.
For those who aren't fortunate enough to come down here and experience New Orleans and your music firsthand, let's say somebody out there says, I really want to take those Pfister sisters home.
Ooh.
If I had a nickel for everything.
Okay, your CDs. Okay,
right,
your CDs. Where can they find you?
Well, you can go to www.pfistersisters.com.
That's PFISTERSISTERS.com.
You can also download, you know, information about us, press kits about us, and we keep our schedule there. We keep a little ongoing log there.
Ladies, for the Bozzies.com audience, and just in case the sisters have upgraded their broadband up there in Radio Evan, can you give us a Bozzies goodbye?
Oh, good heavens.
Goodbye.
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 Goodbye.